Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is Responsible Day for the third day of Kislev. Today we're going to have the opportunity to actually see two tshuvot, the first one of which is pretty short, from Meshiv Davar, from the Netziv, and I have so few opportunities to share Netzivs that I sort of extended myself a little bit. The second tshuva is a little longer, and I hope we'll get to both in a meaningful way. Two tshuvot of the Netziv. One is from Meshiv Davar Bet Ayin Gimel, from the third day of Kislev of Tuf Resh Mem Zayin. And it's the shorter one, that's what I'm taking it on first, so I want to make sure we get to it. It's about, so Tuf Resh Mem Zayin, let's remember, is 1886 or 7, depending on when Kislev was that year, but almost definitely 1886. Ishashi Likane wrote B'Shabbos Kodesh. Shechal B'Yom Tov. Woman lights candles. It's a Friday night, but it's the beginning of a Yom Tov as well as a Shabbos. Now, the important point here is that Yom Tov interrupts Avelut. So if somebody were sitting Shiva, just take a regular case, somebody were sitting Shiva, and Yom Tov happens, so it's the third day of Shiva, the fourth day of Shiva, even the first day of Shiva, the Yom Tov ends the Shiva. So here what happens is she lights candles, and then she hears, I guess the telegram just comes, or messenger just comes, but she hears that she has Avelut. It's something that sadly a relative passed away. Then she's an avel. Vinhaga avelut. She acted like an avela. She acted in mourning for the short period of time between when she lit candles and when it got dark. Question is, does that period of time qualify her as having observed avelut? Because the halacha is, if you've observed avelut before the Yom Tov, then the Yom Tov cuts off the avelut. If not, not. So, for example, suppose somebody heard about, let's suppose an avelut happened. Sadly, somebody passed away on the first day of Sukkot, and they bury the person, Kol HaMoed. So, avelut, the Shiva, doesn't start till later, because you didn't ever start it. So, Yom Tov cuts off on avelut that has already happened. So, that would be true as well. Nowadays, it's less common for this to happen. There was a time when communication wasn't so good. Let's say you heard about something only on a Yom Tov. So again, the Yom Tov wouldn't cut it off. And the halacha is that if you hear about it within 30 days of the event, you have to, it's called a Shmua Kirova, and the Jew is required to observe the full Avelut. So, the person passed away, sadly, on the first day of Cheshvan, Mar Cheshvan. Family member doesn't hear about it till the 20th day of Mar Cheshvan. That family member, nonetheless, has to sit a full Shiva. If they heard about it, though, so let's say a person passes away now, let's go, person passes away the 15th day of Elul, family member hears about it just on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah also cuts off Avelut, that's discussion, but our custom is Rosh Hashanah cuts off Avelut. They hear about it on Erev Rosh Hashanah at noon. They sit 3 hours of Shiva, 4 hours of Shiva before they have to get ready for Rosh Hashanah, cuts off the Avelut. So if the person has heard about it before Yom Tov and acted with Avelut, they have. So in this case, she lit the candles, which theoretically means she's accepted the holiday upon herself, and therefore should theoretically mean she doesn't have the ability to observe mourning. Then there's no rabbi around. She hears about the situation. She acts as an Avela, and she wants to know if she's going to be required to sit Shiva after the Chag. I also point out that we, in halacha in general, the assumption is, I think recently people think it's not true, the halacha in general, the assumption is that the more lenient position is to allow for less sitting Shiva. Many people today think, oh no, sitting Shiva is so great, I want to be able to, it's so comforting, so this, so that. So however people's experience is, that's their experience. But in halacha, the assumption is, and her assumption seems to be, I did a little bit, after Yom Tov it's going to be a pain in some way to sit Shiva, am I required to sit Shiva? So the Tziv says he thinks that if she's already acted as an Avela, it's clear to him that that it counts and that she does it to the Shivas. Because the first issue is, the Rambam actually holds that there's no such thing as Tosefet, Shabbos, and Yom Tov, really. And that the whole idea of Tosefet doesn't mean anything significantly. It's not our topic, we're not going to get into it. But therefore, that in that time period, it wasn't really Yom Tov in any way whatsoever. So when she acted as an Avela in mourning, it's fine. She says, but she lit candles. But lighting candles isn't an acceptance of Shabbos and Yom Tov, according to the Rambam, and therefore it doesn't count for anything. But you might say, no, maybe even the Rambam agrees that lighting the candles qualifies as a sort of a custom that people have accepted. They've accepted that custom that the lighting the candles starts the acceptance of the period of Shabbat, and therefore it becomes like a vow, and therefore she's obligated to keep Shabbat in its full ways. And the Levush had said that, the Kabbalat Shabbat, that when we say Kabbalat Shabbat, that's like a vow to keep Shabbat, and therefore it's like you've accepted Shabbat, but it's not a real full vow. It's like a neder, because she didn't say, I am now accepting upon myself Shabbat. And therefore, when she encounters the mitzvah of Avelut, and she fulfills it, that's going to push aside whatever Kabbalah, whatever acceptance there was, whatever neder type, whatever vow type acceptance there was of this. He supports that point with the Gemara that talks about when somebody tends to come to shul. Gemara in Brachot says somebody tends to come to shul regularly, and then one day they don't come, Hashem asks after them in a negative way. Hashem is upset about the fact they chose not to come. But if they didn't come because they had another dvar mitzvah that arose, another mitzvah opportunity that took them away from shul, then it's great, and then they get credit for it. So the Tziv says, you see that even good customs that people have, if some other mitzvah comes along, that can push aside the good custom, as long as it's just a good custom to hear too. Her good custom is to accept Shabbat when she and Yom Tov when she lights candles, but since right after that a mitzvah came along of acting with Avelut, then it should be good. Then everybody should agree that that was a good, valid opportunity to push aside the acceptance of Shabbat and Yom Tov. And we in Halacha, in Avelut, always paskin Kedivrei HaMekel, like the lenient view, which would be to allow her less time. So where we are now, and I got interrupted, so I may be talking in the middle of a sentence, but where we are now is that even according to the Rambam, accepting Shabbat is at most a sort of an implied promise to do a good thing and a good deed, and that can be pushed aside by another opportunity, missed opportunity that comes one's way, which would mean in our case that she already observed Avelut, and that was a good deed in terms of that's an obligation, and therefore, and we follow the lenient opinions when it comes to mourning, then we would count that as having observed mourning, and she would have fulfilled her obligation to mourn for this relative. Then he writes, but that's all if she's already done it. She comes to us and says, this is what I've done. But if she comes and says, what should I do? That's more of a problem, because our general halakha is actually that we follow the Bahag. The Rambam holds the halakha, and they wrote lighting candles and starting Shabbat early or starting Yom Tov early doesn't fully count in halakha. It's just like a good deed. But we generally assume, like the Bahag, we follow the Bahag, that lighting candles is an implied acceptance on Shabbat, and it has d'oraita ramifications, it has biblical ramifications that Shabbat has started for that person. And that therefore, and we think that there is a concept of adding to Shabbat and Yom Tov, and therefore it's fully Shabbat for them. So once that person has accepted full Shabbat, they can't say, oh, mistake, I don't want to. So that's the way he thinks that we generally paskin, and since we generally paskin that way, then it's not clear to him at all that we would tell this person that she can now observe Avelut, and therefore she would probably have to wait till after Yom Tov to start her Shiva. So that's the first Shiva of the Mishiv Davar, about women who hears, it could be a man too, but a person who hears about an Avelut that they need to observe after they've already accepted Shabbat, and the ways of accepting Shabbat and Yom Tov, and how that can or cannot, that does or doesn't impact what the question of whether they can now decide to observe a quick, brief Shiva in order to fulfill the obligation. Much earlier in his life, on this third of Kislev, on Tav Resh Chaf Gimel, the third of Kislev of 1862, in Meshiv Davar 4-5, Chelek Dalet Simon Hay, talks about a man who married a woman, and the woman gets a job, and they didn't have any children. When the man has never been married before, has never had children before. She gets a job in the house of a rich man in Vilna, and so she's going to go to Vilna in the house of the rich man, and he's going to stay wherever he's going to his job, and they're going to have a long-distance marriage, as it were. And so he sends with her something to sell or to change, like money to change into other money, and it's a significant amount of money. It turns out to be about 200 rubles, and she runs away with the money. And it's more than a year that she's disappeared. She leaves her job and she runs away. You know, it's a nice amount of money. She runs away with the money. And people have looked for her in Vilna a lot and they can't find her. And now the husband has no wife and he has no children. And there's a mitzvah to have children. So he wants to get married again, right? And he wants to build a family. So the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, in the beginning of Eben Ezra, the first siman of Eben Ezra, says, in a place where she'ain harishona bat gerushin, let's say you have a man who's married to a woman, and the woman cannot get divorced. How can a woman not get divorced? Let's say she has left her senses. So in Halacha, if a woman has completely left her senses, she literally, technically, legally, cannot be divorced. The Ramah says in that situation, or if he is supposed to divorce her, and she doesn't want to accept a divorce, so our custom is that men don't have multiple wives anymore because of what's called the Keren Rabbeinu Gershom. Part of Keren Rabbeinu Gershom, however, was also that men wouldn't divorce women against their will. So she's unwilling to accept a get. So the Ramah says, if she refuses to accept a get in a situation where there's no halachic reason that he's required or supposed to divorce her, so then it's much more complicated. It's not clear that we don't force her to accept a get, and it's also not clear that we allow him to marry somebody else. So the Ramah's case that he's talking about is, she can't accept the get. Halachically, legally, technically, there's no way for her to accept the get. Or she's refusing in a situation where the clear halach is that she's required to get divorced. In those situations, the Ramah, we allow the man to marry somebody else. Now, the reason we would allow it is because by Torah law, he's allowed to marry somebody else. And by the Gemara never says he's not allowed to marry somebody else. It's only Chayr Ben Gershom. So since it's Chayr Ben Gershom, the Ramah says that's our custom. We'll get into why over the course of the tshuva. But he gives two examples of how it would happen. Right? One is she cannot, or the other one is she's refusing. So there's room to say, says the Netziv in Meshiv Davar, that you could say if she's not doing anything wrong, Be'ena Poshat, if she's not doing anything wrong, and there's some way, even though it's a distance way, of finding a way to get them divorced, then you'd have to do whatever you can to try to leave Chayim Rabbein Gershom in place, rather than just saying to him, oh, you know what, marry somebody else. And he says, the Netziv says, that would seem to be why the Chatam Sofer said, if you have a woman, Shene'evda, a woman who's lost, meaning she's disappeared, we don't know where she is. And there's no indication that she's done anything wrong. It could be, you know, her ship went down, and sadly, as used to happen, and nobody knows what happened to her, and there's one aid that she's passed away, that she died. So in terms of saving the men, like we do for women in reverse, but in terms of saving the men from ego and from being left alone with no possibility of getting remarried, we would accept one witness. As opposed to, says the Chatam Sofer, benishtatet. If she has lost her senses, and then there's an Eidechad Shemeta, and then there's a witness, a witness that she died, so in that situation, the Chatam Sofer said, you don't need to accept the Eidechad, because we don't, it does, because he's not Me'ugan, even so, because he has a het there of, based on the fact that she's Nishtatet. There's a whole halachic system of how men get remarried. So the Eid Echad doesn't need to help us. We have another way of doing it. I mean, the Chatam Sofer said, we're only going to extend ourselves if the man's really being left alone with no way to get around it. But if he has a way to get around it, no, it's more onerous to get around it if she's nishtatet. He has to do more. If she's lost her senses, in order for him to be able to get married again, there's more he has to do that we'll see in a second. Whereas if she died, there's much less that he has to do. So he'd rather, in terms of his efforts, he'd rather accept the one witness who says she's died than have to pretend that she's still alive or act as if she's still alive and do what we need to do. But the Chatam Sofer says it doesn't matter to us. The fact that he has to put in more effort doesn't make a difference because he has a way to get remarried. So since he has a way, we're not going to go out of a way of our usual halachic practice, which is to look for two witnesses about a woman passing away before we would assume that she did in fact pass away. So the Netziv says, but I'm not sure that I think that that should be the exact comparison, because even though it's true that when she's lost, you say, well, there's no way for him to get out of it, but in Nishtatet, if she was out of her right mind, and now we have rumor that she died, could be that she came back to her senses, and therefore he thinks that you didn't have to accept the Chatam Sofer's ruling in that situation. He thinks that it could be that even if she was insane or out of her right mind when we knew her, and then a witness comes that she died, then maybe you can accept that testimony because you can't be sure that she's still out of her right mind, and therefore whatever way it was, he could have married another wife if she were still out of her right mind. It's not clear. Anyway, that's a whole discussion of its own. Coming to our discussion, though, he says he thinks that the Chatam Sofer would agree that here where she's hiding herself, that would be even better than Nevda, and where she got lost and you had one witness, because she's hiding herself. So if she's hiding herself, that means that even if we find out where she is, if she hears that he's coming and he's about to find her, she'll run away more. She'll find another way to hide herself. So that's even more likely of a case to be lenient with the husband that he is Mu'ugan than if she just has disappeared. We don't know where she went. We assume she's lost at sea. We only have one witness that she died. So that's, we're saying, well, we don't know what's going on. But here we know what's going on. She's running away. He also suggests that her running away is very similar, or is reasonably similar enough to as if she had left the religion. Sadly, all throughout Jewish history, people have chosen to leave Judaism. And in the case of an Ishtamda, a woman who's left Judaism, the Ramah Paskin, that we allow the husband to marry another wife. But the minhag in Austria is to give her a get. Not when she's not there, because she doesn't care about a get, because she's left the religion, so she's not going to participate in any of these religious ceremonies anymore. But what you would do is, you would give a get to, you would appoint a messenger on her behalf. Normally, we're not allowed to appoint messengers to accept a get on a woman's behalf, but here, the Ramah says, we assume that this get is actually to her benefit, even though she doesn't realize it. And the reason why it's to her benefit, as we'll see later in the response, is because if she's still married halachically, then every time she has sexual relations with another Jew, that's a capital, or non-Jew, that's a capital crime. So that, and if she ever has children those children will be mamzerim. They'll be Jewishly illegitimate children forever, and all their descendants will be. So that giving her a get in that situation would seem to be a merit for her, a good thing, a value for her, even though she doesn't realize it. So the situation, he says, so it seems like everybody agrees that if he had a way to divorce her, that he would. But if he didn't have any way to divorce her, we find a way to let him marry somebody else, even, and we don't make him try and go to her and say, in the case of Nishnamda, we don't make him try to go to her and say, please accept a get. Why don't we do that? Because she's the one who has taken action to destroy the marriage by converting out, by leaving the religion. Here too, this is the Nitziv. The Nitziv is saying, since she's the one who's fled and run away with the money, she's the one who's causing the problems. And therefore, that makes us require less of the husband in terms of trying to find the original way of ending marriage. That would be true even if he had children. But when he doesn't have children, right, so there's going to be even more of a situation because he's got a mitzvah period of rivi as an obligation, halachic obligation, the Torah obligation to have children. So if she's refusing and she's gone away, then that even gives more space and more room to help him get out of the marriage. Now there is this custom, he says, that people know of called the Heta Meirabani, from three medinot, that before you let a man get married a second wife, you require him to get the signature of 100 rabbis from three different countries. I mean, you make it a big deal, a big Tircha, big effort that he has to put in to find legitimization for his desire to take on a second wife. That's in the Shutt Maharami Rittenberg, you already have it. But the Tziv says, I don't think you need it. You don't think you need 100 rabbis in our situation because, first off, and this goes back to our Rashba, the Rashba and the Rama reported it, said that the Cheder Ben Gershon was only given until the end of the 5th Elef. So the end of the 5th Elef came in 1240. And then after that, even though we continued keeping it, we keep it as a custom, it's not a cherim anymore, and therefore, if a particular person doesn't keep it, that's a less of a situation. Now, that doesn't the same thing as saying, well, a Jew today can just randomly decide to go marry a second wife. But it is true that if a rabbinic authority says to a Jew, in this case, you're allowed to marry a second wife, the tzitzit says, we don't need a heter merabanim in that situation. And you'll notice that the Rama that we quoted at the beginning of the tshuva didn't mention heter merabanim. It was just talking about situations where he can marry a second wife. If she is not able to accept a get, or if she refuses to accept a get in a situation where she's required to accept a get. And the Beit Shmuel says that that's because the Rama didn't think he needed a heter merabanim. And the Beit Shmuel said that's because if you'll look later and have an answer, when the Rama talks about another situation, let's say she was a sinta, we know that she's had an affair, and other situations where it's an obligation on the husband to divorce her. So the Rama says there very clearly, the Qayrim B'nai Gershon doesn't apply. And what he means by that is that the Qayrim doesn't apply at all. It's not that you need 100 Rabbanim to uproot it. And so then there's a long tshuva here, a long discussion here about Qayrim B'nai Gershon and how it works and doesn't work. And it wasn't our central topic, so I skipped over it in the name of time and space. But this says in the Nitziv, since the Rashba and other Rishonim agree that in places, in various situations, Rabbi Gershom did not make his cherim at all. One of those was the mitzvah period of Rivia. So you have a husband who's got an obligation in period of Rivia and having children. You have a wife who's not participating in that because she's run away with his money. So in that situation, the cherim Rabbi Gershom wouldn't apply, and therefore he should be allowed to marry a second wife. And that would mean, therefore, that he's either allowed to divorce her, Baal Korcha, against her. Well, now she's not present to be divorced, or to marry another wife. And the Rama agreed to that in the situation that he was talking about, where she was Zinta, where there was an actual halakhic obligation that he should divorce her. And it was only, the Nitziv is suggesting, it was only when he already fulfilled the mitzvah period of Rivia, and then a problem comes with the marriage, like she lost her senses, or there's some other halakhic reason that he's required to divorce her, and she doesn't want to. So when there was a cherim b'nai gershon that was still applying, and it didn't specifically deal with that situation, so that's when the custom became to look for a heter merabanim. But after the end of the Elef HaShishi, after 1240, after the 5,000 year when the cherim went to, the Rama thinks you can do such situations even without 100 rabbanim. And by the way, there were those who disagreed with the Rama. The Maharshal disagreed with the Rama, but the Maharshal thought that the gzerah went on forever. The cherim b'nai gershom continues, so it's in full force in our times. And the Maharshal also thought that there was no such thing as a heter merabanim. He didn't think that when Rabbeinu Gershom made his original decision, made his original decrees, that there was a loophole of if 100 rabbis in three countries say that you can ignore it, that you can ignore it. He doesn't think so. So if you're going to go that way, then you're going to have to give up on all of these heter merabanim kinds of situations. So the So the heter mirabanim in that situation, he says, that's not. It's not like a heter. It's like an uprooting of chayyur ben gershom. It's those 100 rabbis are like a large beit din, a large court, who are sitting down to say, we've judged this issue, and this issue is no longer, and we're uprooting it completely. So that's a more radical view of how you would handle it. But to have one person be able to get married, there's no evidence they held that's what you're supposed to be doing. So according to Maharshal, it seems like we have no way to get around this at all, and that's not the outcome that we want. But if we rely on the Ramah, then you don't need. And the Ramah, he points out, Shepashta Horato b'chol Yisrael. The Ramah is like a posek for the Ashkenazi Jews, as opposed to the Maharshal. Maharshal was a great rabbi, an important Talmud Chacham. People quote him all the time. But when it comes to halacha, certainly the Ramah is a more of an influence, more of an authority. And therefore, if the Ramah and the Maharshal have a dispute, and the Maharshal's version of it leaves us with no options for this man, and the Ramah's version leaves us with an option for the man, so we're going to do it, especially since the Ramah is pointed to Rishonim, whereas the Maharshal is not pointed to Rishonim. He's pointed to Rishonim like the Rashba and other important Rishonim about what Rabbeinu Gershom did or didn't do. Then he goes into a lengthy discussion that I'm also leaving aside in the name of space, although I think I'm talking quickly today, so I think we're going to finish a little earlier than we usually do. But there was another discussion about, let's say a man is married and they're not having children for whatever reason, and he hasn't filled his mitzvah period of Arivia. Do we force the couple to separate? There is halacha that if a woman has not had children for 10 years, they should separate so the man can fill the mitzvah period of Arivia. That's emotionally very complicated. And halachically, the Netziv is talking about whether, in fact, halachically we require to them, so the Beit Din would involve itself and say, you must separate, get divorced, so the man can marry somebody else, or not. But now the Netziv says, that only explains why we wouldn't force him to do it. He thinks that we don't force him in this situation. But to make it difficult and impossible for him to do so, when he wants to fill the mitzvah period of Ruv, especially in our situation, I think it's got to be weighing on the Netziv's mind. In our situation, it's not like they have an actual marriage. Meaning if the husband in an active marriage, as far as we can tell, came before us and said, listen, we're not having children, I want to get divorced, and she doesn't, she's refusing to accept the get, whether or not the Netziv would have passed the exact same way in terms of needing or not needing a heter mirabanim, I think is an interesting question. But here, it seems to me clear that since she's not around, and he's got the mitzvah period of Arivia of having children, he says, how could it be that we would put barriers in his way to fulfilling a mitzvah in the Torah? Especially since he's a poor man, he's got a job, he needs to keep his job. See, he's not like he can wander all over Europe finding rabbis who will sign his heter mirabanim. And the Chatam Sofer himself, who was otherwise pretty strict about this kind of issue, admitted that when it came to a situation like this, you had three people that he knew of, three men that he knew of, that Yatzum and Ashita, which I think means they left Judaism because they weren't finding a way to get married. They didn't want to live alone, and so they left the religion. So you have a regular guy who all he did was his wife ran away on him, and he wants to get married. What are you going to do? And he says, V'chol masha ador parutz biyoter, ra'oi shelo larich alehem yoter midai. When you have a situation where the generation of people are not going to keep things, they're already breaking the bounds, breaking the bonds, and breaking the rules, so you don't want to make more rules. So this guy right now is an observant guy, and he's sticking with halacha, and he's coming to us for a solution to his problem. We need, basically, it's the same, we need to extend ourselves as much as we can to help him out. And you tell him, well, I'll let you get married again if you run all over Europe when you're a poor man who needs a Jew as a job. He's going to say, well, I'll just live with somebody, or I'll just this, or I'll just that. So it's saying you got to be careful about that stuff. And therefore, he thinks that we can allow this, Rabbi Yitzchak Aharon, to marry another woman without the heter mirabanim. But then he says, don't rely, you can't only rely on me, on my opinion. He says, which I'm pretty sure is Rav Yosef Dov, which I'm pretty sure is the Beis Halevi, because the Tziv and the Beis Halevi taught together in the yeshiva in Valazhin. And that's a whole story of its own, that they saw learning in very different ways. The Tziv is ascribed to be a person who focused more on bikiyut, on breadth of knowledge, and the Beis Halevi has a proper progenitor of his son Reb Chaim and his great grandson the Rav and other in the Brisker tradition, the Revelvola. I don't want to leave anybody out. That whole tradition was a tradition that focused on depth of understanding and insight into it. So they were very different each other from each other. And Shiva, whatever it is, they got along to at least enough of an extent. He says, and I'm coming with an idea, I think this guy can get married without a heter mirabanim, without needing 100 rabbis to sign the document. But I want the Beis Halevi, he calls him Rav Yosef Dov, I want him to agree, and I want another of the great Torah scholars of the generation to agree. So maybe not 100 Rabbanim, but you're going to have to get 3 Rabbanim to sign off on this permissibility. And then you can rely on it. But also, you know, let's talk about the woman now. Because even though she ran away, she's got some rights as well. So in terms of the ketubah, in terms of the what's supposed to be the divorce settlement, financial divorce settlement, the fact that she ran away does not yet lose her the money completely. Especially since nobody said to her, listen, if you do this, we're going to fine you. Meaning when it comes to money, if I have $1 million somewhere and I do something terrible, right? So that terrible thing, if it doesn't cause damage to others, if it causes damage to others, then you'll take the money because you have to pay off the damages. But whatever that terrible thing is, unless it has some financial ramifications, it's not like we can just go and take the money unless the person is warned. So here too, there's a ketubah payment that's out there. So it's true that if a woman leaves a marriage, she forfeits her ketubah payment, but only she has to be warned ahead of time that's what's going on. So we didn't do that. And then she also might have claims. Maybe if you brought her into court, she would say, I didn't run away from the marriage. He was beating me and he was this, that, whatever she could claim. We don't know. We can't know. And therefore, he does owe her ketubah until he can show or she could, you know, it turns out that she doesn't deserve her ketubah. But the fact that she ran away is enough to put the burden of proof on her such that when we're allowing this man to marry another wife, we're not going to require him to put into escrow the money for the ketubah. In other situations, we would require him to put that money into escrow for her if she ever came to get divorced or to whatever, because we want to protect her rights. Because even though we're giving him the right to leave the marriage, we want to protect her rights. But in this situation, since she fled, we don't. And if she comes to court to demand it, then we'll deal with it, and then we'll look into the situation. So the situation of where we do require him to leave a ketubah for her is where she's gone insane, and so she's institutionalized or something, we're going to allow him to get married again because she can't be part of a marriage and cannot accept a get. So that's part of our taking care of. The verse in Tanakh says, "Ptach picha le'ilem." Somebody's unable to speak for themselves, we're supposed to speak up for them. So that's what's going on in that situation. But here, because she's not around on her own accord, she's the one who chose not to be around, we don't require to do that. Also, here's coming back to something we mentioned already earlier, he says you have to leave a get for her. Sorry, not that you have to leave a get for her, that she can pick up what she wants. You have to actually appoint a messenger to accept the get, which ordinarily we're not allowed to do, but you appoint a messenger to accept the get, and you give the get to her so that to the extent that zikui haget works, it'll work for her. Normally, zikui haget does not work because we assume that she wants to stay married until she tells us otherwise, and therefore we're not allowed to assume that it's a zuchut for her, a merit, a credit, a benefit for her to be divorced, and therefore we're not allowed to do that. In this situation, we allow ourselves to do it because we're worried that when she's off, having run away, that she might meet a man, and she might decide that she likes that man, and she might decide to have an affair with that man. If she has an affair with that man, it's an affair. Whereas if we now, and then if she has children, they're mamzerim, as I said before, whereas if we now have this husband give a get for her, so, and then if she ever comes back, she can pick up the get herself as well, but yeah, you can give a get for her because you can hope to avoid at least some of those problems. So that's what you do. You allow the husband to marry. Before he marries, he gives her a divorce. He does it by appointing the court appointing for her a shliach lekabalah, a messenger to accept it. Then he leaves the get for her. She comes to pick up the get whenever she wants to, and then she's divorced. So that's what he says. Then after he wrote all this, he says, and then I saw the Sefer Nachalat Yaakov by the Gaon Milisa, who's also, I'm pretty sure, the Netziv of HaMishpat. He also wrote a book called Nachalat Yaakov, and he quotes there a Shit Rabbi Kiva Eger, where both of them seem to agree clearly that when a woman is obligated to get divorced, and she doesn't want to accept the divorce, that you don't need a Heter Meir Rabbanim. So that supports the Netziv's idea that the Heter Meir Rabbanim was an important practice in various situations, but there are also lots of situations where we can allow a man to marry a second wife, even though he doesn't have Heter Meir Rabbanim, and that supports his point of view. So that is the second of our tshuvot for the third day of Kislev, both of them from the Netziv. Today, the Netziv on observing Avelut in the last moments before Shabbat Yom Tov, even after lighting candles, and the Netziv on whether a man always needs a Heter Meir Rabbanim if he's going to marry a second wife for various sad reasons that might arise. And that is a responsible day for the third of Kislev. Have a great day.